Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, everybody. This is a live edition of The Main Course. I'm Patrick Martins. We're broadcasting out of Roberta's Restaurant, 261 Moore Street. It's a rainy day, but it's still full, and there's a big holiday market about to happen here where all these local Brooklyn businesses are going to be selling their wares. So come on down if you're close. We are engineered and produced by Joe Galarraga. Joe, are you there with us today?
Good morning.
Hey, Joe. How are you?
Doing well. How about you?
Oh, pretty good. Pretty good. Not much sleep these days. There's like a screaming kid at the house. So this introduction, this intro segment will reflect the kind of ADD, kind of topsy-turvy life. It'll be unorganized as opposed to my usual intros, right, Joe, which are so, you know, focused.
Very and, tight.
Yeah, very tight. Very tight. So well, we had our first board meeting for the Heritage Radio Network, which was kind of cool. Chris Paracchini, the owner of Roberta's, Michael Harlan Turkell, the host of one of the best shows. God, why is his name of his show escaping me?
The Food Scene.
The Food Scene, of course, and myself. Of course, the executive director is Erin Fairbank. She did an unbelievable job. So we looked at the budget, we talked about the future, and you know, there's a lot of exciting stuff going on with HRN, including membership numbers. That's really rising. So we encourage everyone to spend their $60 and become a member. You get a lot of benefits, discounts at various businesses. Today, we're going to talk about meatballs. We have Daniel Sharp in studio with us, which is a huge honor because everyone's talking about the meatball shops. It's very, very interesting. We're going to get a fascinating insight into you know, some of the secrets people might not know behind that very successful restaurant group. But it's been a big week in news, and I haven't done a show for a while. So I was just thinking about all the things that I talk about with my friends. Well, first of all, a freshman won the Heisman Trophy, Manziel, and that is the first time ever that a freshman won the Heisman. So that was kind of impressive. He's a very energetic quarterback. I thought that was kind of cool. What else? In sports, the Knicks got good. All of a sudden, the Knicks are a dominant team. I mean, they were the laughingstock. They called it the worst managed franchise in all of professional sports. That guy, I mean, I shouldn't even mention his name. I mean, he's such a horrible owner. But, I mean, the Knicks were literally the worst. And my friend Toby was like, hey, Pat, how do you think they're so good? Like, what the hell is happening? And it was interesting. I was watching ESPN and or one of the shows, and Magic Johnson was like, well, you know, now we have these statisticians that come in and are starting to break basketball down in stats to the same degree that, like, baseball and football, which are just, there's so many crazy stats. I mean, in baseball, I don't even understand baseball shows anymore because they have so many statistical terms. They're like, you know, his FIFA is 2 points higher than his FEMA and blah, blah, blah. And these are all about batting averages with runners in scoring position. And, you know, it's real like high-tech computers doing all this stuff. And it's finally coming to basketball. And one of the things that these statisticians have told them is that the most high percentage plays are either dunks or three-point shots. So, for instance, when the Knicks beat Miami, I think they took some unprecedented amount of three-point shots. And they just are like, listen, if you're going to shoot, you might as well either dunk it or take a three-point shot and you get 3 points instead of two. So who knows if they're just taking advantage of these kind of stats, you know, stat work and stat knowledge that now is just starting to penetrate into basketball. Well, Nets are even good. I mean, it is very, very strange. I mean, there's been a crazy few months. The Hurricane, the Knicks, and the Nets are doing well. I mean, everything's crazy. What else? What else? There was that suicide of the nurse. I don't know if you heard that. Just so crazy. This Australian radio station did a prank call and, you know, called what is her name? It's escaping me.
Kate Middleton.
Kate Middleton, and they prank called and pretended they were the queen, you know, and they were like, oh, I want to hear how the little bean is doing. Could you patch me through to the room? And this lady did patch her through. And the nurse indeed did think that she was talking to the queen and, you know, gave up some, you know, fairly mundane stats about, you know, Kate Middleton and how she's doing, you know, and it was kind of funny. You're like, oh my God, I can't believe she got patched through. What if they had said something truly, you know, detailed about her medical situation? I mean, that's not supposed to get out like that. But then the next day, this woman commits suicide. And, you know, even though she had two kids, this nurse commits suicide. And, you know, it just shows what a massive hold social mores have on us and class issues. I mean, obviously this lady's crazy to have committed suicide. I mean, that's outrageous, I think, in any situation, but it just shows, like, she's like, oh, I can't go on living because of this mistake I made to these people that are so important. And, you know, I always think that we're kind of like imprisoned by these rules, and it's unfortunate because then it seems a lot of times that unfair things happen. You know, for instance, I work for Heritage Foods, and you know, there's an account that owes us $26,000. And should they be mentioned? Social mores would be like, absolutely, one doesn't do that. And I'm not going to mention them now, but, you know, should they be mentioned? I think, of course. Of course they should be mentioned, you know, to protect other small businesses like my own, you know, who, you know, get ripped off by an account like that. You know, and also for these people to be called out for basically, you know, Bernie Madoffing, you know, various small other businesses. And they're like, well, listen, we're all paddling upstream. And I'm like, well, yeah, you can paddle upstream, but you can't take my paddle. That's illegal, you know, and but, you know, one isn't supposed to say anything. That's not proper, you know, and that seems wrong to me, you know, and I'm working on this book, and this is one chapter that says, you know, eat a Democrat because, you know, Republicans are, you know, always full of it. And they're, now, is that bad to say, you know, when in reality, I mean, I was really looking, I could not think of a single sustainable food issue where the Republicans vote the way I think, or I could say we collectively think. So is it bad to say that? I mean, we would become Republicans if they started voting correctly and believing in the issues of protecting small family farms and all that. But, you know, I don't know. There are all these social mores, and even big publications like, you know, The Times or Food and Wine Magazine, they have these sponsors that they're beholden to. So anyway, it just makes me an even bigger admirer of what's going on this station with the 27 shows and the things that we're able to say without fearing repercussions from sponsors. It might be also why we're don't make a profit and we don't have that many sponsors. But, you know, I do think it was very sad, and it all kind of got put into perspective by this poor nurse that committed suicide. I mean, we are too controlled by these rules that, who makes them up? I mean, it kind of seems like rich white people make them up. But in better news, we're talking about one. We have a person I'm a big admirer of in studio with us, Daniel Sharp. And, you know, another chapter in my book, which actually mentions you guys in particular, is, you know, the meatball might be the most democratic of all food types because it's very inexpensive. It's, you know, at least on a small level, not that hard to make and, you know, easy to support sustainable businesses when you're just making $1 meatball and, you know, putting it on pasta or over bread or something. So I'm a huge fan of the meatball, and Daniel Sharp is, you know, leading the king of all meatball restaurants. So thanks so much for coming in on a Sunday.
Hey, thank you for having me.
So there are three meatball shops right now in New York, one in the West Village, one on the Lower East Side, which was the first one, and one in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, and now two are opening, one in Chelsea and one on the Upper East Side. There's also a commissary kitchen here in Bushwick, just a couple blocks away from Roberta's. So this is a definitely expanding restaurant group. So just for people who don't live in New York or who don't read the papers or anything like that, just give us a brief summary of what is the meatball shop? What would someone see when they go in, and what kind of food do you specialize in?
You know, the meatball shop is a brainchild of Mike Chernow and Daniel Holtzman, the two owners, and they wanted to open a restaurant that was casual, that they could have a good time in. We all have worked in a bunch of different places, and the stress of fine dining and, you know, the rigors of running a restaurant are real. And so they wanted a casual eatery that you know, the staff and everybody could enjoy, that, you know, you can invite your friends in and not feel like you're putting them out, you know, when you hand them the bill. So that, you know, that's the inception of it. And meatballs were kind of the vehicle that allowed them to do that. And, you know, the first restaurant was really, really successful. And I came on board. Daniel and I know each other for a long time. And so I came on board when he was ready to expand into multiple locations. So, but, you know, I think a lot of what we offer is just, you know, good value and a relaxed environment.
It's very relaxed. The menu in particular, right? I mean, you basically check off what you want.
And yeah.
You have different kinds of meatballs, different kinds of sauces.
It's all pick and choose. We have a variety of different meatballs, variety of sauces and sides. And that's really, I think, one of the secrets is that, you know, we have really great market sides and other options, so that, you know, when you're in a group, these days, it seems like everybody's got some sort of eating particularity. So it's very difficult, I think, often for people to get together in a group and everybody feels satisfied with the restaurant choice. So if you have a restaurant that like ours where you can really kind of craft whatever menu or dish you want, it's very accessible for larger, you know, groups of four people where everybody has some sort of different dietary restriction.
What is your most popular dish, you know, couple dishes, and without alcohol, what would that person spend for that most popular kind of menu option?
I mean, our heroes are $10, and they are just, you know, they come with a side salad and they're real filling. So that is, you know, a real easy one.
$10, huh?
Yeah.
For a side for a meal.
Yeah.
That's impressive.
And, you know, we call them our naked balls, just meatballs and sauce in a bowl. It's $7 and our sides are $5. So, you know, if you want to go that route, it's still very inexpensive and, you know, that's very filling. So
basically, you're competing with fast food prices almost. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can go to McDonald's and spend $10 very easily, you know, if you don't get the $1 things. So that's very impressive because you also support sustainable businesses.
Yeah, we are really trying to, you know, pricing is very important to us in the sense that, you know, we want to keep it as low as possible, as accessible as possible, so that we have a broad reach. I think that's really one of our hallmarks of the business is not getting a, we have to really work hard to make sure that we're as efficient as possible so that we can offer our customers a low price point. Whereas I think a lot of people make the mistake of just raising prices to give themselves a little cushion, but then the efficiency drops off. So,
how many covers do you do at your most popular restaurant on a popular day? I got a Saturday.
You know, we'll probably max out about 800 over a day. I mean, we're open for a very long time, from noon till 4 a.m. on a Saturday. So we're
800 covers. So what's the average time? People stay a little less time at your restaurants, or is it?
Yeah, it's a leverage, you know, and that also includes some of the takeout business that we do. But we're pretty fast. Our restaurant's built for speed, so people, it's kind of a hybrid between a full service restaurant experience and like a fast food, you know, walk up, order at the counter kind of thing. So, you know, you sit down, there's a waiter service, but you pick and choose, you know, you pick off or check off your menu and hand it over to the servers, and the food comes out really quick. And, you know, so we can do a lot of people very quickly, and make a lot of people happy.
Now, your particular role is a fascinating one. I mean, you kind of specialize in the expansion of, I mean, you came on after the first place had already existed. You worked there for a few months, and then you kind of took on this hugely interesting role in the restaurant industry of expanding this very popular concept. So let's kind of break that down. How do you expand from the real estate to the kitchen design to making it work? Take us through your job description.
Yeah, this has been I am a cook by, you know, training, and I've been a chef. And so when I came out here, this was really an opportunity for me to do something different in terms of understanding the business of restaurants, you know. So we went from 1 to 3 restaurants really quickly. We started, Brooklyn was the second, West Village was the third. By the time I came on board, you know, they were already in the planning stages. But we looked at the situation of what we had, and we made some modifications to, like, our kitchen design. And it's a big push, you know, to... We're all kind of new at this. No, it's, we're not, we're a small business. We're all people that came up through the restaurant industry. We don't have, you know, it's not somebody who has done this before. So we're all kind of learning as we go along. So
you'll go into a place. So, for instance, you now have this one on the Upper East Side. So you go in and, I mean, the real estate deal, you'll be involved with that with other people. But then you'll go in and decide where the tools go, how many people, what staff to hire.
Yeah, we look at the space first off.
What space? What do you look for in a space? Does it have to have a minimum size or?
There's a lot. I mean, we have a team of you know, the two owners, Mike and Dan, look at the space. And, you know, they have different eyes for what works for us, as opposed to, like, you know, layout and the location versus the aesthetic. And then, you know, when we go in there, we start to lay out, you know, the seating, where the kitchen is going to go. And, you know, we're adapting our concept, even, you know, little tweaks slightly as we've expanded. So, It's exciting to see, like, how, you know, you can use, getting to do it repetitively is a really rare opportunity to be able to open two businesses and say, hey, you know, usually if you opened a restaurant and built it out and designed it, you'd be like, and there was something you didn't really, you thought you could have done better, you're not going to get a chance to do that again in any time soon. But we've gotten the chance to keep doing it and keep refining it and tweaking it a little bit to work better for us.
Are there any very obvious do's and don'ts of setting up a kitchen that you learned as you went, or that might even be applicable to young chefs who are in culinary school listening to this show?
One of the big things is I think it's transitioning between being a cook and being, you know, somebody who designs a kitchen, is this idea of when you're cooking and you get crammed in these small little work environments and you're like, God, wouldn't it be just great to have a big kitchen with lots of all this stuff and lots of, you know, equipment and smallers. And one of the really interesting things is there is a definite efficiency you get from compacting everything. And a lot of times making a kitchen bigger and easier to work in really doesn't benefit the efficiency or the work that gets done there. It just makes it easier to, it makes it easier to kind of slack off and like not notice things, I guess.
Mm-hmm. If you had a restaurant like Del Posto Kitchen, for instance, that wouldn't necessarily be 50 times better because it's 50 times bigger. Sometimes the compactness helps the whole system work.
Yeah, you gotta look at yourself and what you're doing. And you know, when you have a big space to cover, you need it becomes a physical issue of you need people to look after those stations. So if you compact everything and, you know, you're in a lull period between lunch and dinner, then you can have one person work two stations, and that's a big important one. Now we have a prep space, but in our some of our locations, we split the we made the basement a prep kitchen and the upstairs a line, and that's something that we've moved away from just because having two kitchens essentially means that, you know, upstairs and downstairs, it's a lot harder to manage. So you need two chefs almost to one working upstairs, one working downstairs to make sure everything's going correctly, as opposed to if you have one larger kitchen on the same level, mm-hmm. although it may, you know, may not have as much space altogether as two, it's a much better model for us.
So now, and then the mixer, what is the basic, you know, way that, is there a grand manger station? I mean, does the meatball shop use the traditional kitchen makeup? I mean, we've had hundreds of chefs come onto the network and explain more or less the trajectory of their kitchen, of the food coming in to going to the table. Does the meatball shop break a lot of those rules because of the nature of the menu? And
yeah, it's not quite the same, although, you know, our breakdown is pretty simple. We have our sandwiches, which we refer to as breads, and then the naked balls and sides. So those are actually the two, like, fundamental stations in our restaurant. Now, obviously, we run with a few more people, so we have an expediter who helps out, and then we have a person doing what we call the backups, that is restocking and refueling this this machine that's going on. But we run pretty lean and tight, and, you know, we'll bring in, we have salads, so we'll bring in, you know, when it's really busy, somebody will be the guy who does the salads and some of the cold sides, you know, as the volume increases. But those are basically our two stations.
Hmm.
The side station is a saute. It's a hot pickup.
Hot pickup. Now, talking about the work of it, when you do expand and just making it work, your work ethic and all of this, and you were saying to me earlier, you know, how interesting it is because there's no routine, basically, when a place is expanding all the time. Like, when you go from one to three restaurants, do you triple the staff? How do you break up to have new people come in, but you keep some people at an old restaurant, but who do you bring into the new without hurting the old? I mean, tell us about the work of your group.
That's been a real interesting one for us because when we started, Stanton Street is a postage stamp of a restaurant. It's tiny, tiny, tiny. And Brooklyn was a much larger space. And we didn't physically have the room to train people. Like, in the kitchen, if, you know, you were an extra body, you were in the way. So we had to be very, very selective about who we brought on prior to opening Brooklyn. So we focused mostly on bringing in management candidates. So when we opened Williamsburg, the only people that really had any experience in the meatball shop were all the managers, which was really odd because then that meant we got stuck running the line for the first week or so while we tried to simultaneously you know, put out the food and train the staff. So that was really difficult. Now that we have more restaurants, we have the luxury of being able to carry an extra person or two to train them. So when we open up, it's a mix between experienced people and brand new people. And that's you know, something that that you're afforded with a larger with a set of restaurants.
And you just figure stuff out. I mean, you take what you knew from the old place and you try to adjust it to the new place. But, I mean, you also are in different neighborhoods. So, I mean, does the Upper East Side, is that going to break from the precedent? Or is it just much of the same? I mean, is it just like a photocopy of sorts?
Yeah, we try not to veer too much from what we do because we just would like it to work. But there are considerations that we make in terms of the layout of, you know, considerations like, hey, more family, so make more four tops as, you know, we're going to have a private dining space there, you know, to, because feeling is there probably more like birthday parties or soccer parties or things like that. The menu itself, You know, each location has its own chef, and there are specials that we do, seasonal specials. But, you know, we don't gear it really, you know, we don't have to adjust the menu that much. I mean, at the end of the day, it's meatballs, and they are kind of universal, so.
And is there, like, are you guys going to be like McDonald's, where they say any McDonald's that still opens now is going to take business away from another McDonald's? I mean, is that your thing, to have every neighborhood having a meatball shop? And then would you go into other cities as well? Or is that a kind of asking for it, because you would really be spreading too little butter over too much bread?
I mean, that's a big question for us. The great part is every event we do, every time, you know, we go anywhere, people are very encouraging and responsive, and they're like, oh, it would be great if you open one up here in my town, in Miami and LA and San Francisco. Everybody wants a meatball shop in their town. So it's really awesome to hear. We the reality of growing a business like this, you know, we're not a big restaurant group, and we don't have like this like a trust backing us,
yeah,
or something.
Limitless resources.
Yeah, you know, we're just doing this on our own, and we're figuring out as we go along. So it's a big challenge, and the big challenge of getting out of New York is taking what we have now as a team that can expand and also manage what we got going on. So being able to hit all your restaurants in one day is a really strong position to be in, and to move into another city would mean we'd have to just split our management staff up. And that's a difficult one. That's really tough, because that is, I feel like, what the limit, how fast you can grow is really more of a personnel than, you know, you can always find a location, do construction, but getting the smart people to look after your business is a very difficult one.
What about within New York? I mean, what is the capacity? Not to say that you would be the ones to do it or that you even want to, but could New York, could Manhattan sustain 30 meatball shops or 20? I mean, this seems like it's inexpensive. I mean, you could almost compare it to fast food in terms of accessibility. So you're not really eliminating any of the public by saying, oh, there's four of them on the Upper East Side. I mean, or, you know, in the West Village.
Yeah, that's a question for us. And to be frank, we don't really know the answer. We are curious ourselves to see if we can keep going. But, you know, New York is so dense that our Chelsea location is relatively close to our West Village location. But it's a whole different demographic. It's a whole different group of people. Feel the traffic patterns in the city are very interesting, and the neighborhoods kind of link up via like the subway pass than they do of physical location sometimes. So you get people kind of swimming in different currents, if you get my drift. So we'll see how have no plans to leave New York, or expand beyond New York at the moment. But it is a real question if we can keep growing in this city. Definitely easier for us. But at what point do we hit that, like, hey, enough is enough. Like,
yeah.
Let's get out of town.
It's an interesting question. Now, why has not anyone opened more meatball shops? I mean, you know, just as a guy who doesn't own restaurants or work at restaurants, I mean, I'm wondering, could someone go to your restaurant and copy you and then go to a place like Oakland or even, you know, Queens and just be like, we have a meatball shop? You know, what is the secret? What is the work? What is so difficult that other people... Because if you think about it, it's the most simple thing in the world. It's the meatball. I mean, it exists in every country, probably has some version of the meatball, and yet you've patented it in a way that no one else ever has. And people talk about you all the time, but I don't see a competing meatball company anywhere.
There's a special alchemy that you know, really goes back to the owners Mike and Dan hit on, and their relationship to each other in this business, which is, it's a lot of fun, and there is so much energy in the restaurants that is young and people are there having a great time. The food's inexpensive. But at the core of it, there's a lot of hard work. And it is a really simple idea. And people are like, oh, meatballs, like that's so easy. Like you just roll it. And the day-to-day work and keeping on top of all the stuff that can go wrong in a restaurant and managing the people and keeping people happy and working hard and tasting the food and making sure the food quality is up there is the secret of it. And, you know, you can take a good idea, but a good idea in a restaurant means that if you bust hump and work hard every day, that you have an increased chance of success. And that's about all I get to. A good idea and without the work behind it is doomed to failure just as fast as any other concept.
So how many people work for you guys? What's your currently once you open the Upper East Side and Chelsea locations?
Well, right now we're hovering around 150. You know, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of about 50 per store on average.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So wow. So it'll be up to 250, and the managers are first in, last out, right? I mean, until it gets figured out. So do you find like when that restaurant's going to open that you three guys plus Michelle and your core management team are going to be working 6 day weeks, 15 hours a day?
We really put in our time during openings. It's you know I remember Brooklyn was riding my bike home when the sun's coming up and just trying to get as much sleep as possible.
It's like having a baby.
Yeah, it's pretty much. And you just, you know, we put in our time and work hard. The interesting part is the harder you work, the less time you're going to have to put in there eventually. So it kind of like you just try to push through that opening period and get everybody get their feet underneath them so that you can get some sleep someday soon.
Now, my last question on the work thing, what do you look for in a worker? I mean, obviously they do the work well, but I mean, what tests do you put them through? Like how quick they figure it out or how little they complain? I mean, I'm thinking about young kids who are like, I wonder if I have what it takes to work with those guys, run with those guys. Like, what would you tell them?
The ethic is the most important thing. I mean, you can train anybody who wants to work. But the not feeling, there's definitely, you know, you get these kids who have an ego and some entitlement and they you know, it's like, you're just like, I'm sorry, bro. It's just not going to work out. You know, you're not ready to, listen and do the work. And that's a big one for us. So, we really like to grow within, and a lot of our chefs have started with the company, and have some of them this was their first kitchen job, and they've been with us for a few years now and have grown, and we've taught them and grown into management roles, and that for us works really well.
Interesting. Well, we talked about other cities, but you guys are from the West Coast, right? Born and raised. I mean, your aunt has a very famous restaurant that I had no idea until a few minutes ago that it was your aunt's restaurant, and the Inn of Seventh Ray, which is, I think, goes back a while. It's like an old, not hippie restaurant, because that doesn't mean good food. That means bad food usually. But there's a very famous kind of vegetarian nod to vegetarian food. I mean, it's famous.
Yeah, it's a really old restaurant. My aunt started it in the 70s.
Wow. Seventh Ray.
That's where I kind of cut my teeth in the restaurant industry. I would spend summers down there. I grew up in Northern California. This is down in just outside of L.A.,
in the Topanga Canyon, you said?
Yeah, really kind of removed up there in the hills. And when I was a kid, I would bus tables during the summer months. And then after college, I moved to L.A. and worked there for a long time as a waiter. And actually where I started cooking was I kind of got tired of the waiting tables and got interested in food. And
so your aunt brought you in the kitchen?
Yeah, the chef at the time, I asked too many questions, so he put me on the salad station a couple days a week. And then a couple of days a week turned into full time, and then that was kind of it.
Wow, and that's also where you met Daniel Holzman, your
Daniel partner. Daniel came. I'd actually left for a while. I went to Italy to do some cooking, and I didn't have any interest in retracing my steps. But they had hired him And for some reason, everybody was like, oh, you got to meet this new chef. You guys would really get along. And so we did. And I really kind of had the mindset that I wasn't going to go back and work with, you know, him, mostly because I just didn't want to go backwards. But when we met, we really kind of hit it off. And it was actually chicken wings. We both were talking about our love of chicken wings and our disdain for people who try to put their twist on the buffalo wing. And you're like, it's just the simplest recipe. All you have to do is just make it, and it's delicious. And if you try to make a, you know, your own Asian-inspired buffalo wing, all you're going to do is going to anger me. And so we ranted about that, and that was kind of a...
That was a bonding experience. Yeah, and you guys followed each other to Northern California, right?
Yeah, we worked together. He went up to... open SBQR with Nate Appleman, so I went and worked at A16 SBQR with those guys.
That was an interesting time for that restaurant group. I mean, that restaurant group's interesting. People have come in and out of there, and it's always talked about. There's always energy there. I always remember Carlo Petrini, the founder of Slow Food, said at the time that both you guys were there that that was his favorite Italian restaurant outside of Italy. So that was high praise for A16, and ever since then, we've focused on it, and it's fascinating how many people came through there. So you helped them out with both those restaurants, huh?
Yeah, it was great. I mean, that's where I really fell in love with wood-fired cooking at A16. They had two ovens, one that did pizza, the other one just did hot apps and entrees, and I think to this day, it's the most fun I've ever had cooking was just... It was like a four-hour fight with a large ball of fire every night.
And then whole animals, right? I mean, you guys are bringing in whole pigs all the time. So
yeah.
It was hardcore all the way through.
It was the kind of restaurant as a cook you just always hoped you get the opportunity to work in.
It's interesting. I mean, for San Francisco, it was really ahead of its time in a way. Like in New York, it would have been a great restaurant for sure, but there might have been others similar to it. But in San Francisco, it broke new ground. What did it do? I mean, what did you guys bring to it that, again, had not been brought by other chefs to that part of the country? Was it just the simplicity of using an open flame?
Yeah, I think there was the simplicity on a whole level where... It shed a lot of the pretentiousness of the dining world at that point. And, you know, it's this open kitchen, you know, where, you know, we didn't wear chef coats and you could just see everything. I mean, I remember lunches when we'd break down the animals in the open kitchen and there's a chef counter and people would be eating and, you know, you'd see Nate like going to town on this pig, breaking it down. So, it really was all about the food and put the food and the taste of the food first. You know, wasn't fancy plating. It was very rustic, and that kind of, I think, really got people interested in this idea of like, oh, like once you stop putting things into ring molds and fussing with them, actually it's really a lot better if you just put it on a plate and send it out.
Yeah, or a mason jar.
Yeah.
You would have those dishes in the mason jars, I remember, that would have been like pâtés and such. And then you just followed him here. He opened his thing here, and you guys kept in touch because you guys liked each other back from the chicken wing days? And
yeah, after that, I stayed in the Bay Area for a while. He came back out here to open the meatball shop, and I remember coming out to visit him before he opened, and you know, it was fun and great, and it was like a runaway success, and when he was going to expand, he called me up and was like, hey, you know, really could use some help here.
That's great when you hear those stories of people who've been in the business. Michelle, your colleagues, is like, oh, you've been around for a minute, talking about me and Heritage, and it's nice when those collaborations last over decades or, you know, many years, and people are still in it, still working hard, and then find ways to cross paths when the opportunity presents itself. Well, you had a kind of weird pop-up in Oakland, so you did bring Meatball to a different city, at least for a night or two. Was that pop-ups are happening everywhere. It's like a new phenomenon. How did that go for you?
Well,
did it work?
That was an overwhelming success.
Oh, wow.
It was really crazy. Again, with that whole people in the business, a really good friend of mine named Kyle Atani just opened this restaurant called Hopscotch in Oakland.
Got a great review, you just said.
Yeah, Bauer's Chronicle review just came out a couple weeks ago. Really great review for him. Mm. We're so happy. He and I worked briefly together back way. I worked at a Japanese restaurant for about 6 months, way back in the even before I met Daniel. And we've just stayed in touch all these years. And he was bouncing around last year, not trying to put together this restaurant, and he was available. We needed some help opening our Greenwich location. He came out, helped us out, and so now he's got this restaurant. It's in a nice part of Oakland, but it's a little off the main drag. So I was out there a couple months ago, and we were talking about how to drive some more people to his place just to get, you know, his name out there. So we had this idea of doing a meatball shop pop-up, and I approached Mike and Dan about doing it, and they were really excited about the prospect. So
didn't you need to bring your tools or anything? I mean, your big equipment that makes it, or?
Well, what we did was the meatballs are, you know, yeah, we have a bunch, you know, grind them. So we brought the meatballs. We packed them in coolers and checked them in on the flight.
Really?
Yeah. very expensive meatballs. But actually, that worked out. And then,
not local.
Yeah, this one is going from New York to Oakland.
Kansas to New York to Oakland, Oakland, really. Yeah.
So those that was kind of the only way we could do that, because his restaurant is even smaller than our meatball shop. So, but then we made all the sauces and sides there.
And he just promoted. Has his restaurant been open already?
Yeah, his restaurant's been open for a few months now. So
and you just came in and it became the meatball shop for a night.
Yeah, we took it over. Put a, you know, we had a limited menu, and we'd had some good press, and our PR did a good job of pumping us up out there. And it was a Monday night in Oakland, and we had a line down the block. We brought approximately 500 portions and blew through those in about 3 hours.
Wow, that reminds me of Alice Waters told me when she got her start, because, you know, while she was in California, people didn't really know her nationally, but Tavern on the Green had this big dinner. Michael Batterbury was involved, and Paul Prudhomme saved her butt because she was overwhelmed when she had to cook for all those people. But she actually brought patches of dirt with vegetables in it on the plane, you know, and she came here. Now, it's very interesting. This is just, that's where she got her start. She said, she was overwhelmed. She was like, there's no way. I mean, people are going to have to wait there 3 hours for the dinner. And Paul Prudhomme was like, I'll give you my entire staff for a few hours just so you don't make a shit show out of this. And she did. She still carried out her vision, but, you know, so it was kind of an interesting story. But very few chefs go. Many chefs come into New York from other places, but very few people I've noticed go into San Francisco and Oakland. Like, if you guys are like, oh, or even Mario Batali or Danny Meyer or all these people that might open in a different city to go into San Francisco, why is that? Is it a very tight fraternity, or is it a hard city to penetrate? I didn't tell you I would ask that question, but I just wonder.
I don't know. I've always wondered that, because going from San, I guess when you're in San Francisco, I felt like I was more aware of stuff going on in New York. But I feel like when you're in New York, there's so much stuff going on here. It's very hard to look out. Mm-hmm. So I mean, when we were planning this trip out there, I was like, oh, I hadn't kept up with the new restaurants. So, you know, I was calling, talking to people, where should I eat while I'm there? What should I do? I really had no idea. And I just think it's a matter of perspective. You know, mm-hmm. New York has that way of just locking, absorbing all your attention and being very hard to look outward. And I think that's probably most of it. Out of sight, out of mind, you know?
Very interesting. Yeah. Although, you know, Northern California, I mean, barbecue, Northern California, and New York. I mean, those seem like the three, you know, the triangle of food inventions in this country. Yeah. I mean, they really come, and yet they don't necessarily go.
I had a really exciting meal at a place called State Bird Provisions while we were out there.
State Bird?
State Bird, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
What was that? In San Francisco
in
proper?
In San Francisco, yeah. It's on Fillmore. And it was a really, they have an interesting service style, which is they have a dim sum cart. And it's not dim sum by any stretch, but they come around and and offer you plates. And so instead of ordering, you can just choose a plate.
I like that.
Yeah.
There's a place called Fiorello's right in front of Lincoln Center where you point at all the salads you want, you know, and you can get six or eight. You get the peppers, you get the octopus. It is nice to eat that way.
Yeah.
I mean, you guys offer that too, the choice, right?
Right.
Well, very interesting. This fascinating. A very comfortable conversation. We could have gone on for longer. I had other questions about how Meatball is so successful. But thanks so much for coming on. I hope you come back. We should have a panel. We've had Michelle on. We've had Daniel on. Now we have you. So, you know, we're big fans of what you guys do. And you guys are super successful. So congratulations.
Oh, thanks for having me. This was great.
Yeah. Well, this has been another edition of The Main Course, the most prolific show. Prolific not in terms of listeners, certainly, but in terms of most shows, right, Joe?
Yeah, you're still you're top of the list, Patrick.
Well, thanks. That helped that I didn't tell anyone the station existed for the first 3 months so I could get my head start. But it's good to be back after a few weeks off, and we'll be back next week. And thanks so much for, I guess, Joe, could you run that great spot that you guys did for the ICC before you take us out to break? Because we're big fans of Dorothy Cann Hamilton and her amazing school that's churned out so many chefs. And thanks for listening, and stay tuned for Straight No Chaser.
The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.